Okay, so let's get started. I presume most of you were able to make the discussion section yesterday. Okay, so the first lab assignment is out, as was announced in the discussion section. It has been posted on the course webpage. I'll have spend a few minutes on it at the end of the class. Okay. And the important thing to keep in mind is this is just a warm-up assignment, just to make sure you have sufficient Java expertise to finish the assignment that we will start handing out in a couple of weeks. Okay? In other words, the weightage for this assignment is going to be substantially lower than the real assignments. And the goal here is to just to make sure everyone is comfortable with Java and you can actually program some simple exercises. Yes, you had a question?
It's going to be about the assignment.
Let's talk at the end of the class when I bring up the page and just show you what it is about. Okay? It's due in 2 weeks. Okay, that is sufficiently generous to do this relatively simple assignment. Feel free to form groups if you want, although you don't really need to form a group for this assignment. It's a good time to form your group so you are prepared for the real assignment that will hand out in a couple of weeks. Okay. Let me just recap what we did last time, and then today what we are going to do is a basic introduction to computer architecture basics. All of the background material we assume you have some handle on. Okay, so last time I basically did a quick introduction to operating systems and gave a history, or sort of described the history of how operating systems have evolved. This is the picture to keep in mind. Okay, so essentially it's the piece of software that's going to sit between the hardware and your user applications. The hardware essentially presents a physical machine interface to any software that runs on it. What the OS does is it uses this physical machine interface and exports a much easier to use logical or virtual machine interface to the application. So the users and applications don't need to deal with low level messy details of the hardware. Instead, you are given higher level abstractions like files and processes and whatnot. Don't need to deal with lower level issues like disk blocks and registers and processors and so on. Okay, so that's the thing to keep in mind. And so the agenda for today is to, I'll give a quick overview of some basic OS functionality. As a recap of last time, we'll talk about architecture of a machine. What does a machine look like? What are the key components? And then we'll see, based on what functionality is available in hardware, what can the OS provide to applications and end users? So how are specific hardware features on any machine used by the OS to provide higher level services? Okay, so in particular, what are the services an OS provides and what specific hardware features do you need in order to provide those services? Okay, so that's what we will see. And what you will see is what the OS can do is really dictated by what the hardware can support. Okay, depending on what is supported, you can do more or less. Okay. And the architectural support will dictate how much complexity is in the OS. The less support you have from the hardware, the more work the OS has to do to provide the same functionality. That's what we will see. Okay. So with that, let's talk about OS functionality. I alluded to this last time. Okay. So the operating system provides a number of useful services or has different functionality ranging from concurrency, dealing with I/O devices, managing the RAM or the memory on your machine, managing files or disk space on the machine, and providing access to other resources on a network. Okay. So let's take each in turn. So concurrency is basically the issue of doing multiple things at the same time, okay, or simultaneously. So this can be anything from I/O processing, where there may be different applications or processes that are trying to access files on the disk concurrently, and the OS has to ensure that all of these I/O requests are handled in a concurrent fashion. Okay, or it could be something like running multiple programs at the same time. You may have multiple processes running on your machine. They are all running concurrently. The OS has to manage these processes. Okay, so it provides this notion of concurrency, which allows either multiple users to use the machine at the same time, or allows multiple applications to run on the machine at the same time. Okay, so that's fundamentally what concurrency is going to give you. Okay. And the way you do this is you can have either threads or processes, as we will see in subsequent classes, that are all executing on your machine, and the OS ensures that each one can execute in turn, and so all of them can make progress at some rate. Okay. So that's concurrency. Okay. So then the OS has to manage I/O devices, and as I was mentioning last time, the basic insight here is to overlap the computation and I/O. Okay, when some application is running on the CPU, some other application may be blocked and it is actually doing I/O. So some processes may be using the I/O functionality while others are running on the process. So this overlap of computation and I/O allows multiple applications to make progress at the same time. Okay. Memory management. So if you have multiple processes running, each of them will have some code and or data loaded in RAM. And as far as the OS is concerned, it has to manage memory. It has to determine which process gets how much RAM, okay, and which area in RAM is allocated to each processes. And it has to manage this RAM. It has to ensure that one process does not get inadvertent access to the RAM that has been allocated to another process. Okay, this is called protection. Okay. So you have to coordinate the allocation of memory and moving of data between disk and memory. Okay. You may be loading code or data from disk, it arrives in RAM, you may be evicting stuff from RAM, so it goes back to disk. Okay. You have to manage, the OS has to manage disk space. Okay. So you take a raw disk, you put a file system on top of it, and then the applications get this abstraction of files and folders and directories. Okay, and the OS has to manage all of this. Processes may be creating files. It has to allocate disk space so that you have some place on disk where the data of this file is going to reside. Okay? It has to ensure that files belonging to one user shouldn't be accessible to another user if the user doesn't want someone else to access it. Okay? So again, you have to provide this notion of protection, allocation of disk space. When you delete files, there's corresponding disk space has to be freed up. Okay? So all of this management of disk space is the responsibility of the operating system. Okay? And last but not least, most machines will have a network interface, whether it's a wired interface or a wireless interface. This will allow applications and or users to access resources on a network. Okay? And the OS has to actually manage how the network card is allocated to processes. Okay, when you, let's say you have a browser, you try to access a web page, what happens is your browser is going to construct an HTTP request, hand that to the OS. Okay, and then the OS has to send that over a network, wait for a response, when the response comes back, hand that back to the browser. Okay, so all of this again has to be managed by the OS. Again, multiple processes may be trying to do network I/O simultaneously. You have to arbitrate access to the network card across processes. Okay, so all of this is functionality that you will find in any modern operating system. Okay, exact semantics of how you do this may change from one platform to another, but basically you have to implement all of these components in an OS. Okay, so we have looked at an OS in different ways in the last class. Okay, so one way, or one way to think of an operating system, is that it juggles the allocation of resources. Okay, it provides the illusion of a dedicated machine, okay, with effectively lots of RAM and lots of CPU, and allows multiple users, multiple applications to share these resources, and it juggles the allocation of hardware resources to applications. Okay. Another way to think of an OS is as a government that protects users and applications from one another, so it provides safety. Okay. And it ensures fairness. It fairly allocates these resources across processes. Okay. Yet another way to think of an OS is it's a complex software system. Okay. It's a very large piece of software with many components that resides on your machine. And by studying how operating systems are designed, you will understand the principles that are used to design any large software system. Okay. And last but not least, we have seen sort of the OS as a history teacher, that has evolved over maybe few decades now. And we have seen how the functionality that the OS provides has changed as technology has changed. Okay, as hardware became cheaper, as more processors are put on a single machine, as the RAM size increases, as network speeds grow, the functionality that you provide has also changed. Okay, so as any large piece of software evolves over time, we have seen an example of how operating systems have evolved over time. Okay, so this is basically a quick summary of what we did last time, okay, in terms of introduction to operating system. And we'll go into most of these things that I mentioned here in quite a bit of detail as we go along. Okay, so now let me talk about computer architecture. Just give a quick introduction to architecture. So what is shown in this picture here is what is inside any machine, okay, any laptop, desktop, server. So these are the key components that you will find inside a machine. Okay, so there are several key components. Okay, the CPU is the processor on your machine. Okay, there is RAM or main memory. Okay, and then there are peripherals. Several are shown here. You may have some disks attached to the machine through a disk controller. You may have a USB controller, several peripherals may be attached to it, the mouse, keyboard, printers and whatnot. There may be a graphics card on your machine, okay, and a monitor may be connected to it, and there may be a network card, more than one, maybe wired, wireless and so on. So those are all peripherals. Okay. And what there's an interconnect that connects these components to one another, and that's your system bus. Okay. So you have these key components and your system bus that connects them with one another. So for instance, your a process or application may be running on the CPU. The code and the data for that process will reside in main memory, in RAM, and then when as instructions execute on the CPU, you will fetch new instructions from RAM over the system bus and it will come into the CPU. You will execute it. Instructions may access areas in RAM to load things into registers and so on. So the CPU and the memory communicate over the system bus. Okay. Similarly, when the process wants to read a file or write to a file, it will have to access the disk through the disk controller. That communication is also going to occur over the system bus, and so on and so forth. So if you want to display something, you basically have to write to your graphics card, which will then display it on the monitor, and that communication also occurs over your system bus. Okay. So the system bus is your key interconnect, and there are these key components. Okay, as far as this course is concerned, we will look at CPU in some detail, we will look at main memory, and all of these other things we will just treat as I/O devices, okay, because they are just I/O devices of various flavors. Okay. So this picture you should be familiar with, okay, as we go along. I presume that you have at least seen some version of this picture in a previous class, right? Okay. Are there any questions on any of these components? We'll look at some more details of these, but this, at least at the high level, is this architecture of what a machine looks like clear? Okay. So now, your hardware might provide various functionality. Okay, and here is a table that shows some functionality that some typical machine might support. And then what I mentioned was the OS provides some services to its applications or end users, and to provide those services you need specific functionality in the hardware to make it easier. Okay, so this table just shows what service will make use of what types of hardware support. Okay, so for instance, to provide protection, you will need user and kernel mode, you will need protected instructions, you will need base limit registers. Okay, we'll look at this in subsequent slides. Okay, to provide this notion of interrupts at a software level, you need hardware support in the form of interrupt vectors. Okay, to support this notion of a system call, okay, you need hardware support in the form of a trap instruction and trap vectors. Again, we'll see what these mean and how you do this. Okay, to do I/O, you need interrupts and memory mapping. To do the scheduling, accounting, you need timers. To do synchronization, you need atomic instructions. To do virtual memory, you need translation look aside buffers. Okay. So I'm assuming that you may not know what is in this column. Okay. But I assume that you know something about what's in this column, and I'm going to review that, okay, in this class. So let's look at each of these in turn and see what that hardware support means and how you provide this OS service. We'll start with protection. So what is protection? So I have mentioned this couple of times. So since your machine, or rather since your operating system, allows multiple processes to reside in memory at the same time and to execute concurrently, it has to provide some notion of protection, which prevents one process from accessing the RAM that belongs to other process, and so on. Okay, so the ways, and the other thing is, you don't want applications to do something that can cause problems on the machine. Okay, and I'll explain what this means in a moment. Okay, so to protect the system from either malicious or buggy applications, you have certain instructions in your instruction sets that are referred to as protected or privileged instructions. Okay, certain instructions, instructions that any process can execute. Okay, this could be load instruction, store, add, move, and so on. These are assembly instructions. But there are certain other types of assembly instructions that you do not let an user process execute directly. Okay, these are referred to as protected instructions that only a privileged process, in this case that's going to be the kernel, the OS kernel, can execute. Okay, so what you do is, you say, here are this instruction that anyone can execute, and if you want to do something specific that can cause damage to other processes or to the machine, we only let the operating system execute this instruction. So you have this boundary that provides the first level of protection. The other way, other thing you need in protection is inadvertent memory access. You don't want one process to access the memory belonging to other processes. Okay, so how do you do all of this? Okay, so the way you do this, okay, as I mentioned on the previous slide, you have these user kernel modes, and you have these protected instructions, and your base and limit register. So the three different types of hardware features that the OS is going to use to implement protection. Okay, let's start with user and kernel mode. Okay, so what happens on most processors is, you have these modes of operation. Okay, when you are in user mode, your processor will only allow you to execute instructions which are not privileged or not protected. Okay, these are the usual add, subtract, load, store, which any process can execute. You cannot do much harm, okay, by executing this. Okay, and then when you are in your protected mode, or what is referred to as in kernel mode, you can then access these other instructions that you are not allowed to access in user mode. If you are in user mode and a process tries to execute a privileged instruction, you will cause an interrupt and the process will be terminated. So you are trying to do something you shouldn't be doing in user mode. Okay, so what are these instructions that are protected or privileged? Okay, so any instruction that allows you to access an IO device is protected. Any instruction that tries to manipulate the state of memory is protected. Any assembly instruction that changes the mode, sets the mode bits, which switches you from user mode to kernel mode and vice versa, is protected. Okay, enabling and disabling of interrupts are protected. The instruction that halts the machine, that's the halt instruction, is protected. Okay? So you can see why use application shouldn't directly access these or be able to execute this instruction. Okay, so let's just take halt. Halt was not a protected instruction. So you could just write a process, write a program that just issues the halt instruction and your machine shuts down. Okay? So if any user has the ability to just shut, any process has the ability to shut down a machine, that is a problem. Okay, because you may not want the process to do this, you want the kernel, which is a trusted piece of software, to do this instead. Okay. And let's take another example. Any instruction that manipulates the state of memory, okay, you don't want any user processes to execute those instructions. Okay, because you want a memory belonging to one process to be not accessible to some other process. Okay, if user programs could directly access, do things that allow you to change page table pointers and whatnot, then you can get inadvertent access to another process's memory. Okay, so those instructions you cannot execute as a user process. Only the kernel is allowed to execute them, or you have to be in kernel mode to execute them. Okay, so the first technique that you will use on, or the first hardware feature that you will use to implement protection, is a user and kernel bits. Okay, which switches you the processor from user mode to kernel mode and vice versa. Okay, and when you are in kernel mode, you can do all of those things. Okay, and it's assumed that only the kernel runs in kernel mode. All processes actually run in user mode. Okay, is this clear? getting some blank looks. Yes, there's a question there. Yeah. So does this exist in Windows XP? So this is a feature of the hardware. So it exists on pretty much all processors. Like if you get an Intel processor, an AMD processor, the processor will actually support these user mode and kernel mode. Okay, they are also called rings. If you have heard of this term ring, if you are in ring zero, that's called the kernel mode. The terminology that's used in Intel for x86 architecture. If you are in ring three, you are in user mode. Okay. Any operating system will make use of this feature. When the operating system is running, you set the mode on the processor to kernel mode, so it can do whatever it wants. It has free reign. Okay? When any process is running, the operating system will switch the mode to user mode. So then it will only be able to do some things, but not others. Yes, there's a question there. Somebody had a question. No, okay. Okay, is that clear? What I just said? Okay. So, any processor, any modern processor that you see today, including x86 processors and others, at least support two modes, the kernel mode and user mode. There may be other modes that sit in between, okay, that get less privileged. Okay, so that's what the OS is going to use to prevent user programs from doing malicious things. Okay, so by using this mode bit, by switching this from the processor from user mode to kernel mode, you prevent process applications from doing bad things. Okay, that's the first feature. Okay. Then the question is, if any user process, so I said users may not access IO directly. Okay. So you have to go through the operating system to access it. So think about what that means. Suppose you want to access a file that resides on disk. Okay. You say you open a file and you start reading that file or writing that file. That's IO. Okay. So your application is doing IO. Okay. But on the other hand, we have said user programs may not do it directly. Okay. Then you have to also ask the question, so if I open a file and try to read it, how do I actually get the data eventually? If I'm not allowed to do I, meaning the user process, is not allowed to access the disk directly, then how does it work? Okay. So the way this is done is through the notion of crossing protection boundary, or really the notion is that of a system call. Okay. So whenever a user process wants to do something privileged, okay, it cannot do it directly. Okay. So it has to ask the operating system to do it on its behalf. Okay. So if you want to open a file and read data, okay, you are not allowed direct access to the disk. Instead, you must tell the OS saying, go read this and send me the results. Okay. So the function or the method that you call, which asks the OS to do something on your behalf, something privileged on your behalf, is referred to as a system call. So it's an OS procedure that is going to execute privilege instructions on the behalf of app user processes. Okay. And the assumption is, since OS is trusted, it will actually check what the user process is doing and only allow it to do valid things. Okay. So if you give a direct access to the disk to a user process, then there is no protection. You can read somebody else's files, for instance. Okay. But on the other hand, if you ask the OS to go read that file, the OS will then first check, is this user process even allowed to access this file? If you have set the protection bits on the file, say if some other user said, I don't want anyone else to access it, the OS will return an error saying you cannot read this file. Okay? This is how things work. So the OS implements this notion of system call that allows any users to do privilege instruction. Okay? And how this works is actually shown in this picture. This is the user process. Okay. It executes in user mode, or the mode bit is one. This is the OS kernel. Okay. It's another piece of software that executes in kernel mode. Okay. So let's assume the user process is executing. At some point it wants to read a file. Okay. That's IO, privileged operation. You cannot do it directly. So instead what happens is you make a system call. Okay. The system call causes a trap. Okay. So think of a trap as an interrupt that basically interrupts the execution of the user process, okay, and causes the kernel to begin execution. So at this point, the user process stops executing, the kernel starts running on your processor. The user mode, the trap also causes the mode bit to flip. Okay, it goes from 0 to 1. So when the kernel executes, the mode bit on the processor is now 0, which means that the kernel can do any privileged operation that the user process couldn't. Okay, and then what you will do is you'll figure out what system call did the user process want to execute. Let's say it's open, then you will actually go into the, so the kernel is actually going to implement this open system call. It will go and execute it. It will go do IO to the disk, get the results back from the disk, and then it will return the results back to the user process, at which point the kernel will stop executing, the user process resumes execution, mode bit flips back from 0 to 1, go back from kernel mode to user mode, and your application now has the data it requested from the file. Okay, that's basically how system calls work. Again, the open and read and write are just some examples. There are many, many system calls that an OS will implement. So the basic steps are similar regardless of what the system call is. Okay. So you will always cause a trap which causes you to jump into the OS kernel. Okay. There's a trap handler for every system call. Okay. So for every call you have to execute some code. Okay. That's called a trap handler. Okay. So you go and execute that function that you called. Okay. And then at that point you have to save the state of the process because you have to eventually resume its execution, which means you will save all of its registers. Okay, before the kernel can begin execution, when the kernel executes the system call, okay, you restore the state of all the registers, and then the process can resume execution. Okay, those are the steps that you will implement for any system call. Any questions on this? Okay, so here are some examples of system calls in a Linux-like operating system. Okay. So I mentioned file management. So opening a file, closing a file, reading a file, writing a file, all of these are privileged operations that the process, a user process, cannot directly execute. So all of them are implemented in your system as system calls. So whenever you try to read and write files, you actually, the OS is going to do that for you. Okay. So you will trap into the kernel, it will do it and return the results. Okay. Starting processes, new processes, all of that, and terminating processes, process management, are also system calls. Okay, and there are many others. Okay, this is just a simple set that I just wanted to put up. You don't need to know what each of them do, just want to give you a flavor. Okay, in Windows, you have the Win32 interface. Okay, that's the equivalent of system calls in Windows. Here is just a table that shows some Win32 calls. Okay, so this includes starting and terminating processes, reading and writing files, changing directories, getting the time from your clock on your machine, and so on and so forth. Okay, so all of these things the OS will implement as system calls. Okay, and the basic point that you should keep in mind is that all system calls require privileged operation that the user process cannot do. So you need a trap to actually jump to the kernel. Kernel executes it for you, returns the results. Okay. Okay. So that's one type, another type of protection. Right? So the other one is memory protection. And here you want, so this is the picture to keep in mind. Let's assume that's RAM. There's OS kernel that resides in RAM. There are other processes or jobs. You want to prevent one process from executing the memory that has been allocated to some other process. Okay. So the hardware feature you are going to use to implement that is what are called base and limit registers. Okay. So whenever a process is executing on the CPU, you will actually set the values of the base and limit registers to that region of RAM, to those addresses in RAM where the process actually resides. Okay. So assume that for simplicity the process actually resides contiguously in RAM. This is not true in real system, but just for simplicity, we'll assume that process 2 is actually resident from this memory address to that memory address. So we'll set the base register address to that region of RAM, to that address in RAM, the limit register to that address. Okay? So at this point, any instruction that this process executes, okay, which causes it to access memory for any region, will be range checked against this base and limit registers. If you try to access any region of memory that is not within the base and limit registers, you will get an interrupt and your process will be terminated. Okay, because you are trying to do illegal memory access. Okay. So all instructions at this point, load instruction, store instruction, add, whatever assembly instructions are, anytime it tries to access any address in memory, you will check against this. Okay, that's what the OS will do for you. Okay. And this is how you will prevent this process from accessing, let's say, this region of memory, okay, or going and trampling over kernel memory. because you cannot really, you are not allowed. The hardware will prevent you from accessing anything that is not within this range. This, when some other process begins execution, the OS will set its base and limit register to this range, for instance. Okay? So this is how you will ensure that you protect the memory of one process from access from other processes. So in other words, you will use this hardware feature, so your processor must support base and limit registers. So otherwise, there is no way for you to prevent inadvertent memory access. Okay? Any questions here? Okay. So what I showed you here was a region of memory where a process resides. Okay, but typically, a process that is resident in memory has a certain structure. Okay? It has certain segments, as they are called. You may have a text segment, a data segment, and a stack segment. Okay? The text segment of a process is that region of memory that consists the code for that process. Okay? That's the code that you have written that gets compiled into assembly instructions and machine code. And that the region in memory where that is loaded is referred to as a text segment. Okay? The process may have global variables. May have data, so that those are stored in the data segment. Okay? As you call methods and functions, okay, any local variables for that or any parameters that you pass into a function, any return values, all of this is stored in what is called a stack segment. Okay? And as you know, as you recursively call other functions, the stack keeps growing downward. Okay? When you return from a function, you pop that part of the stack. When you call a new function, then you add to the stack. Okay, so that's basically what the process layout in memory is going to look like. We will come back to this in quite some detail when we do memory management. Okay, but you have a question here.
Yeah, I was wondering about the difference between data and text.
What the difference between data and text? Text is code, source code. No, not source code, machine code. Okay, data is global variables. Okay, this is not data, this is code. This is data, that's data. Okay, the stack and the data segment are essentially really variables and arrays and all of those things that you have in the process. Those are stored here. This is actually the code for your program. Okay? Anything else? So typically, when you look at any machine, okay, you have what is called a memory hierarchy. There are different components of your machine where code and or data may be stored. Anything from registers to caches to main memory to disk and even the network. Okay. So this forms a hierarchy. And as you go down the hierarchy, it takes you longer and longer to access data. Okay. But there is more and more of that resource available to you to store large pieces of code and or data. And as you go up the hierarchy, that piece, that layer in your memory hierarchy is much faster, but you have less of it, so it must be managed more carefully. Okay. So for instance, the fastest piece of quote unquote memory you have on your processor are the machine registers. Okay. Any variables that are stored in machine registers, you can access very, very fast. Okay, so you have effectively one cycle latency to access anything in your registers. Okay. And then you have the hardware caches on your processor. So you may have what is called L1 cache and the L2 cache and an L3 cache. Okay. So these are caches that are fast pieces of memory, but not as fast as registers. Okay. But you have more of them. So you may have more in the L1 cache. You may have, let's say, up to a megabyte of L1 cache, but you may only have 16 registers. So you've gone from 16 words to few tens of kilobytes or a megabyte. Okay? But it is slower. So you might have tool cycle latency to access any code or data that is cached in your L1 cache. Okay? You may have a 7 cycle latency to access anything that's stored in your L2 cache. Okay? But you have more of the L2 cache. Okay? And then your RAM itself, which has 100 cycle latency. So you've gone two orders of magnitude higher. Okay. But clearly you will have more RAM, you may have 4 gig of RAM on your machine. You won't have as much in L1 and L2 caches. Okay. And then anything you cannot store in RAM, you have to store on disk. Disk is several orders of magnitude slower. Okay. So you have gone from 100 cycle latency to 40 million cycles only. So here you have nanosecond access. Here you have millisecond access. Okay. So anything you have to get from disk, going to cost you in orders of milliseconds. Anything go to RAM is several orders of magnitude faster. So this is basically the memory hierarchy, and then you have the network itself. So if you don't have something on disk, you can fetch it from another machine over a network. That's also going to be slow. Okay. So the point is to keep in mind that any machine has this memory hierarchy. Okay. When a process is executing, different parts of the process, the code segment, the data segment that I showed on the previous slide, okay, so all of these are scattered across this memory hierarchy. Some variables may be in register, some pieces of code may be cached in the L1 and L2 caches, some data may be cached here, parts of the process may be loaded in RAM, some parts of it may be still on disk. Okay, so you basically, depending on what you are doing and what you are accessing, you will see this latency. Okay. And we'll come back to this later, but we'll start with looking at registers and what they do. So as I said, registers is basically one word of very fast memory that is managed by the CPU. Any processor has different types of registers. There are general purpose registers and special purpose registers. General purpose registers can be used to basically store any variable that the process is accessing frequently. And special purpose registers are special functionality. So you have typically the program counter that points to the region in memory which is the instruction you are currently executing. So as you execute this instruction, the program counter gets incremented, you execute fetch the next instruction and so on. Okay. And then you have the stack pointer and the frame pointer that points to the stack. That's the stack segment that I showed you on the previous slide. Then where in memory is the stack for this process and so on and so forth. Okay. So keep this in mind. We'll come back to other types of registers later on in this course. Okay. So I talked about caches as well. Since access to main memory is much slower than access to registers, okay, and you cannot store everything you want in your registers, most processors will support caches. Okay. And caches are smaller regions of memory that are faster than RAM. So you will have certain frequently accessed portions of your program, be it code or data, stored in these caches. And whenever your assembly instruction tries to access some data, if it's in the L1 or the L2 caches, access to it is going to be much faster than if you have to fetch it from RAM, for instance. Okay, so these caches are put in as a performance optimization. They are not necessary strictly. Okay. You could just make do with registers and main memory, but then your performance of your program is going to be much, much slower. Okay. So by having caches that store frequently accessed code and data and are much faster to access than RAM, okay, your applications can run faster. Okay. And you have multiple levels of these caches in most processors, okay, starting from L1 all the way to L3 caches. Any questions on this? Okay. So now I'm going to talk about traps, okay, as the next hardware feature. So traps are essentially special conditions detected by your hardware. Okay, if you know Java, you probably have played around with Java exceptions. Okay. So traps are the equivalent of exceptions in hardware. Okay, whenever there is a special condition you have in your Java program, you throw an exception, you have an exception handler that tries to deal with that condition. This is exact traps are the exact analogy in hardware. Whenever there is any special condition detected in the hardware, you will raise a trap. You will have a trap handler, which is equivalent to an exception handler that is invoked, that is going to execute and try to deal with that condition. Okay? So there are different types of special conditions. Okay? Everything from a page fault, you are trying to write to what is a read-only piece of memory, you are making a system call, you may be trying to divide by zero. Okay, so that's also an exception, so you get a divide by zero for any of these conditions cause a trap. Okay, so on detecting a trap, the hardware will save the state of the process. Okay, it will go into the kernel mode. Okay, it will invoke the trap handler. The trap handler will try to deal with that condition. Okay, and once you are done, then you will resume execution of the process. If the condition requires you to terminate the process, you will do that as well, and then the process will stop execute. Okay. So this is basically a hardware feature that is available for the operating system to deal with any of these special conditions. As I mentioned, the system call is also implemented as a trap. okay, because that's a special condition where the process is telling the OS saying, I need to do this privileged operation. I don't have privileges. Please do it on my behalf. Okay. So any system call, the thing that I was showing on the previous slide, is implemented as a trap. Okay, it causes a trap. It will jump into the OS, and the trap handler is essentially the implementation of that system call. Okay, so it could be a, if you are trying to write to a file, you call the write trap handler, which is the implementation of the write system call in the curl, for instance. Okay, and typically the hardware feature that you use is what is called a trap vector. Okay, trap vector is essentially a vector where each entry corresponds to a particular condition that you are trying to deal with. Okay, so you may have a system call, which is in this case trap number 3. If you try to execute an illegal instruction, that's trap number 2. Memory violation is trap number 1, and so on. Okay, so you have a, there's a question somewhere here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the trap vector?
Yes. So trap vector is essentially the hardware feature that basically is a table. Okay, the table says if this condition arises, this is the address that you need to jump to, and that is where the trap handler is stored. Okay, that's where the piece of code that is going to deal with that condition is stored. So you will see that that's a table of memory addresses. Okay, any questions? Okay. So think of traps as a performance optimization. Clearly a less efficient solution is to actually insert this exception handling code directly into the user process. Okay, but that will be inefficient. So you would rather keep that piece of code once in kernel, and any time any user process has that special condition, we'll jump to it and execute it once. Okay, so that's the way traps are implemented. Okay. So the next functionality that we will look at is I/O control. Okay. So I have shown you a picture earlier where we showed an I/O controller, and you had devices like disks, yeah, that were connected to the system bus. Okay. So the way most I/O devices are implemented is they have this thing called a controller. Okay. And a controller is effectively a piece of hardware that has a small processor in it. Okay. And that processor deals with all of the accesses to the I/O device that is connected to it. So if you have a disk, we have a disk controller. It could be a IDE controller or a SATA controller and things like that. So USB device, you have a USB device controller. Okay. So any peripheral is attached to the controller. The controller is attached to the system bus, and this controller effectively has a processor in it. Okay. And so the way I/O occurs is the CPU effectively issues a command to the controller saying do this. Okay. And then the controller or the processor on the controller will then actually go and execute that command. Okay, so if it's a disk controller, you could actually issue a read call. Okay, so you will, the CPU will issue a read command to the disk controller. It will specify an address on disk where you want to read from, and then the I/O controller will do its thing. Okay, it will go and issue a read call to the disk itself, try to read the data, and once it is done, it will go and raise an interrupt. An interrupt tells the CPU that the I/O command that was issued to that controller is now done. Results are available. So the results are handed back to the CPU, and the CPU can do whatever it needs to do with that I/O request. Okay. This is basically a very high level overview of how I/O devices work. Okay. So essentially what that means is that the I/O devices can work concurrently with the CPU. All that the CPU has to do is issue a command. Okay. And then it can do something else if it wants to while this command is executing. When the command on the I/O controller is done, the controller will signal the CPU using an interrupt saying your request is complete. Okay, results are here available. Okay, now there are different types of I/O requests that you can make, and the two canonical types of what are called synchronous I/O and asynchronous I/O. And the difference between the two is what is the CPU going to do while the I/O request is being processed by the device or by the controller. Okay? If the CPU is going to wait for the results of that I/O command to be available, this is called synchronous I/O. Okay? It's also called blocking I/O. Because you will issue an I/O command and you will block, which means you will wait for the results of that I/O command to become available. Okay? You will do nothing. Okay. On the other hand, if you actually issue a command and then you begin doing something else while the I/O request is being processed by your controller, you have what is called an asynchronous I/O. This is also referred to as non-blocking I/O. Okay. So in this case, the CPU is not going to wait for the request. It will start executing something else, and when the results become available, and the interrupt will be raised and tell the CPU that here is the result. And that's what is shown in this two figure, and this arrows actually show you the request being issued and the results coming back. And here is your CPU, and this is what the process is doing. So in this case, when you're synchronous I/O, your process is going to block. Okay, so in this case, the process is not going to do anything. You will issue, let's say, a read call. Your process will wait for the results of the read to become available. The read call will go from the OS to the device. The device will actually process the read, and at some point results will become available, at which point the process will continue its resume its execution. Okay. You do an asynchronous call, as is shown here. You may issue your read call. If it's implemented as a non-blocking call, then the read call is going to return immediately, okay, saying I received the request, and then the process can start doing something else. It can resume execution on the CPU. At some later point, the results of the read become available. You signal the process with an interrupt, saying here are the results, at which point you stop doing what you were doing, and then you take the results and then you process it. Okay? So these are the two modes of operations that you see. Okay? Typically, if you haven't, by default, most of the I/O requests fall in this category. Okay? They are implemented as blocking requests. It means you issue a request, process blocks, okay? Wait for the results to become available. Okay? But there are programs that try to optimize performance that also use asynchronous I/O. Okay? We'll come back to this later, but just keep these two modes of things in mind. Regardless of which of these two you use, the steps that you will perform are the same, as I showed you on this previous slide. Okay, you will issue a command to the I/O controller. I/O controller will do what it's doing and raise an interrupt. Okay. The only question is, what is the user process going to be doing in between? Will it wait or will it do continue execution? Okay, that determines which semantics you implement. Okay. So another way to think about how I/O requests are implemented is whether they are memory mapped or based on interrupt based. Okay. So if they are memory mapped, what happens is your I/O controller, okay, the piece of memory that's on the I/O controller is mapped into a region in memory. Okay. So rather than issuing commands to the I/O controller, you implement I/O as read or write operation to this special region in memory. And then the controller just interprets those as commands that you have to implement. Okay. So, just to give you an example, you could take, let's say, the graphics card on your machine. Okay. So, here is your graphics card. It's connected to a monitor. Okay. This is system bus. This is CPU. So the way typically the graphics card would work is it would have an input-output buffer. Okay? Your CPU or your program is effectively going to write pixels into this buffer, and the graphics card is going to put that out as a signal which the monitor will display on your screen. Okay? So you can change the value of the pixels that will change the color of what is appearing at that region on your buffer. Okay? So one way to do this, of course, is the method that we just looked at. Anytime you want to output a new image, the CPU will then send a command to the graphics card saying, here, take this piece of memory and put it into this buffer. And then you will actually start reading that RAM and putting it here. And then once it appears here, it will show up on your monitor. Okay. Now, if on the other hand, you use what is called memory mapped I/O, this buffer that you have on your graphics card gets mapped, okay, as some special address in RAM. Okay. So at this point, rather than directly issuing I/O commands to your graphics card, all that your user process has to do is either read or, in this case, just write to RAM. Okay. So in order to write to this region of memory, you just write to some special addresses which are mapped, which basically map onto this I/O buffer on your graphics card. Okay. So in other words, I/O commands effectively become read and write commands to memory. So it's much simpler for you to then interact with your I/O peripherals, if it looks like all you have to do is read or write to special regions in memory, and then the I/O controller will interpret that as equivalent of certain commands you could have issued. Okay, this is referred to as memory mapped I/O, because you have mapped a region of your I/O peripheral as a special region in RAM, and rather than issuing direct commands, you are implicitly issuing commands by reading or writing to regions in this RAM space. Okay. As opposed to this, the other way is what is called interrupt-based asynchronous I/O. This is what I was mentioning on two slides back, where you explicitly issue commands to your peripherals. Okay, and when the command is executed, then you will receive an interrupt back. Okay, so essentially, you will issue a command to the controller, which is a small processor, and then the processor will go and implement the command. When it's done, it will pass an interrupt. The interrupt will cause the CPU to stop executing whatever it was doing, and the way it will do is it has to do all these other things, which is disabling interrupts. We'll come back to all of this. Save the state of the interrupt handler, save the state that the interrupt handler will modify, invoke the interrupt handler, see what the interrupt said, get the results back, restore the interrupt, and then resume execution of the process. Okay. These steps are very similar to what happened when you did a system call. Effectively, whenever an interrupt is raised, you have an interrupt vector that you will basically go into an interrupt handler. Interrupt is also a type of an exception on your machine. Okay. So IOs can also be implemented using interrupts. Okay. You will issue a command, and then when the command is finishes execution and interrupt is raised, you stop executing what you are doing, get the results back from the I/O device, and then you resume execution. Yes.
Is there any practical difference between this and buffers?
Doesn't the buffer
also essentially place an interrupt on the CPU?
What do you mean by buffer? I'm not following.
The
memory mapped I/O, you mean? Yes. If you're using the memory mapped I/O to read something, okay, you will actually have to take an interrupt at some point. Okay. But as far as the process is concerned, it looks like you are only using reading and writing to memory. You don't have to know about the nitty-gritties of which I/O command to execute. Okay. Internally, reading and writing of memory is going to get implemented using interrupts, but that's not exposed to the code that is actually interacting with the I/O peripheral.
Oh, so this is like an operating system for interrupts?
Yes, something like this. It's just an abstraction that you will use, which is easier to use than directly dealing with I/O commands and interrupts and asynchrony. Okay. So we talked about I/O, and the next thing we want to now talk about are timers. Okay, this is another hardware feature, and we'll see how the OS can use it for a variety of different things. Okay. So typically any machine will have a real-time clock on it. Okay, the real-time clock allows you to tell the time on that machine. Okay, the clock keeps ticking. And then another hardware feature you have is what is called a timer, which you can then set saying raise an interrupt after so many ticks have passed on the real-time clock. So you can set the timer to, let's say, 10 seconds, and then the timer will keep ticking, and when 10 seconds have elapsed, it will raise an interrupt. And then the OS can do whatever it wants to do. Okay. So what can you use timers for? Okay, you can use timers to do accounting, you can use timers to do billing, and the most important use of timers on any machine is to switch from one process to another. Okay. Since there are multiple processes residing in memory, okay, one of the functionality that your operating system is going to provide is scheduling them one after another. Okay. So let's say you will start executing process 1, okay, and then you will say this process can execute for 10 milliseconds. Okay, so then you set a timer to 10 milliseconds, and when 10 milliseconds have elapsed, the timer will raise an interrupt. At that point, the OS will say, okay, your turn is done, go back and wait, and then you will say now it's time for process 2 to execute, and you will let process 2 execute for 10 milliseconds, and when another 10 milliseconds have passed, you will say suspend execution of process 2, switch to process 3, and so on. Okay? So you can use this notion of timers to time slice or give small amounts of CPU time to each process in turn. okay, and so on. Okay. You can also use timers in user processes. So you can say, I want to sleep for a certain time. Okay. The way that sleep is implemented is using this notion of a timer, and you can say, I want to sleep for 10 seconds. You have a timer that you implement that says, tell me when 10 seconds have elapsed. Okay. So timers are essentially a hardware feature, and the OS can use them for a variety of different things. And as I said, one of the most important things is to do scheduling of multiple processes one after another. So each one gets some time on the CPU, and then you can make, all of them can make progress. Okay. Now timers are implemented, what is shown here is timers are implemented as interrupts. Okay. So you can essentially set the timer, a value for a timer in a register, and then that register gets decremented on each clock tick. When that register goes back to zero, then an interrupt is raised. And then the interrupt, you have to go into the interrupt handler and say what was this timer for, and then you basically say this is what happened. Okay, you may tell the CPU that's time to either switch processes, tell the application which set this timer saying these many seconds have passed and whatnot. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So the next functionality that we'll talk about is that of synchronization. Okay. We will come back to synchronization as a topic later on in this course when we talk about processes and threads. The goal here is to just understand what is synchronization and what is the hardware feature that you have on your machine that allows the OS to implement synchronization. Okay. So typically, on any machine, an interrupt can go off at any time. Okay. And whenever an interrupt is raised, then the OS has to suspend execution of the process, jump into the interrupt handler and deal with that interrupt. Okay. So packet may arrive on your network card, for instance, and that will raise an interrupt. Tell the OS saying a new packet has arrived, here is some data that arrived over network processing. Okay. Timers may go off. Okay. Any keyboards or mouse clicks that you have on your machine will raise an interrupt, saying the user is trying to do some input into the machine. Okay. So the OS will not be able to control when interrupts can occur. Interrupts can occur at any time. If I press a key on my keyboard, that is going to generate an interrupt. OS cannot predict when an interrupt will occur. Okay. But there are many occasions when the OS is doing something critical that it doesn't want an interrupt to arrive and suspend execution of whatever is happening on the machine. Okay. These are often referred to as critical sections. Okay, in a critical section, you are doing something that you do not want to be interrupted. You don't want, even if an interrupt arrives, you don't want to stop doing what you are doing. You want to finish doing what you are doing and then go and deal with that interrupt. Okay, so that's one thing. Okay, so there may be times when you do not want to be interrupted. Okay, and then there may be multiple processes. The other scenarios, you may have multiple processes running that are trying to coordinate with one another and do something. Okay. So in this case, you want the ability to do some precise coordination. You want something to happen based on what some other process has done. Okay? So we'll come back to examples of what these coordination mean, but for now just assume that you are trying to do some coordination between processes. Okay? So the question is, what functionality should the operating system provide to do all of this? And the thing that you have to do is what is referred to as synchronization. Okay? And then, so what happens in this case is that your hardware provides you the ability to execute short sequence of instructions, okay, which will execute in what are called atomic sections. Okay, so either all of those pieces of instructions execute or none at all. Okay, you don't have a scenario where only some of them execute and then you go off and do something else. Okay, so your hardware or OS has to implement this notion of an atomic section. And what you do in the hardware to do this are two things. One is you have the ability to disable and re-enable interrupts. Okay. So in this case, what the OS will do is if you are executing something very important that you do not want to be interrupted, you can go and say, I will disable all the interrupts. Okay. So now even if some interrupt arises, it is queued up. Okay. You will not actually stop executing these instructions. So only when all of these instructions are executed, then you re-enable the interrupts again. At that point, any interrupts that have arrived in the meanwhile were queued up, they will get delivered to the operating system. Okay? That's one functionality. The other functionality is most processors implement this special instruction called a test and set instruction that's always implemented, that always executes rather atomically. Okay. What a test and set instruction does is it tests the value of a variable, okay, or value of a register, and if the value is zero, it will set that to one in one single instructions. Okay, rather than doing an if the value is zero, set it to one, which would be two instructions, which could be interrupted, you can do a check and a set both in a single instruction. Okay. We will see how these two things are used when we come back to the notion of synchronization and locks and mutual exclusion later on in this course. Okay. For now, all you need to know is that there will be many scenarios that the operating system needs to coordinate the execution of certain things, coordinate the execution of processes or coordinate the execution of certain instructions without getting interrupted, and there are hardware features that allow you to do that, okay, and the two are the enabling and disabling of interrupts and using atomic instructions like test and set. So the last thing that we will look at here is virtual memory, okay, and again this is an entire chapter in the book, but for now I'm just going to talk about the concept. So what is virtual memory? So virtual memory is an abstraction that your OS provides that allows you to effectively assume that you have infinite memory on your machine. Okay? Typically on your machine you have a certain amount of RAM. Okay? If you have a laptop you may have 2 gig of RAM or 4 gig of RAM. Okay? But what the OS does is it basically allows you to get over this 4 or 2 gigabyte limit. You can have as many processes as you want. And the collective needs of these processes may exceed the size of RAM. You can even start a single process whose entire memory needs might exceed the size of RAM. So if you have 4 gigabyte RAM, you could start a process that requires 8 gigabyte of memory. Okay? Typically, if your process needs 8 gigabyte of memory and you have only 4 gigabytes, then you shouldn't be able to run that process at all because you don't have enough memory to do it. Okay? So to get around physical limits on memory, what the OS does is it provides you an illusion, say, assume you have infinite memory. Okay, doesn't matter what you need, assume it's effectively infinite. Okay, so you can start as many processes as you want. You can even start any single process that has a need that exceeds the entire size of RAM. Okay, and the way the process actually allows you to implement this abstraction is by not loading the entire process in memory all at once. If the entire process had to be loaded in memory all at once, and if you had 100 processes and it collectively needed, let's say, 10 gig and you had only 2 gig, there was no way you could do that. You can't fit 10 gig of processes into 2 gig of RAM. Okay? Neither could you start up a process that needs 6 gig when you only have 2 gig. So the way to get around this is to chop the processes into smaller pieces and only bring certain parts of that process into RAM and keep the remainder on disk and bring them as needed into memory. Okay. This abstraction is referred to as virtual memory. Okay. So what this effectively does is it allows you to use more RAM than is available on your machine, okay, by having more processes than the total size of RAM. And the way this does is basically you only bring in smaller pieces of programs into memory as needed and store the rest on disk. Okay. And since your disk is large, okay, you effectively get the abstraction of infinite memory. Okay. Effectively, the size of the amount of RAM is limited now by the amount of disk you have, okay, because you can actually make use of your disk space to actually store pieces of processes that are not currently executing. Okay. So the OS then has to load and unload pieces of programs from your memory. Okay, these are called pages on demand. Okay. So the technique that you use to do all of this is referred to as virtual memory. Okay, again, there are special registers that your hardware has to support in order to implement this notion of virtual memory. Okay? But it's a nice abstraction to provide because now you no longer need to deal with this. Okay, this effectively saying this is the amount of RAM, can I start one more process? Okay, you don't deal with, you can just start processes and they just seem to all run. Okay, and the OS has actually done something for you to make that happen. Okay. We'll come back to this notion of virtual memory, I think, in the second half of the course. Okay. So this is where I'm going to summarize, and then I'll say a few words about the first programming assignment. So the basic point to keep in mind is you need some notion of or some background on computer architecture. I did a very quick review of some stuff that you need to know, okay, which I assume that you might have covered in 201 or something equivalent. Okay. So do go and either read the corresponding chapter in this book or brush up on what you did there, because we will now start talking about how the operating system implements some of these services, okay, that I was talking about. To do that, you need to know what pieces of hardware are already available that the OS can use to implement them. Okay, so some knowledge of architecture is necessary to understand operating systems in quite some detail. So keep that in mind. Okay, so this is was sort of a one lecture review of the material that you will need to know. We will come back to this. I will again do some more review, but it's at the end of the day, you still need to know something about an computer architecture to get something out of this course. Okay, so that's where I will stop as far as the lecture is concerned. I want to go back to the programming assignment. Okay, so as I mentioned, the first lab is up. Okay, it's on the course webpage. I think this was discussed yesterday in the discussion section. So the goal of this is essentially to ensure, okay, the high level goal is essentially to ensure that you know enough Java to do some of the subsequent assignment. The specific assignment itself is to construct a binary search, to construct essentially an inverted index. Okay. So what an inverted index is basically given some text. Okay. An inverted index tells you which words appear in the text, how many times does each word appear, and where in the document or where in the text does that word appear. Okay, so here is an example of some text. Okay, that's the input there. Okay, so it's basically some random text. What your program needs to do is basically construct an index on this data. Okay, and that index essentially tells you, okay, that's what the output should look like. It should say these are all the words that appear there. Okay, some words may appear more than once. So what you will do is you will count how many times each word appears. So this is basically the first thing here is how many times does each of these words appear there. And then the second thing is which line. So there are three lines in that text. Which line of text does that word appear in? So this is the word A appears on line 1 and line 2. Peppers appears on line 1 and line 2 and so on. Okay. So you just need to know, construct some data structures, okay, which will be implemented in this case as a binary search tree, okay, something that you should have learnt in data structures. Okay. So construct this binary search tree. As each word appears that you have not appeared, insert that into the binary search tree. Once you encounter it again, increment a counter saying I have seen this word n times. Okay. And at the end, you will basically have a sorted list of words in your binary search tree. Print them all out. Okay. Some very simple data structures to construct that will do this. Yes, question.
Write the output to a text file?
That you can do either one. You can print it or write it. It doesn't really matter. Okay, question there. Okay. So this is a sample input file. You should clearly test it with other input file. We will test it with something else to make sure it actually works. Okay, but I mean this is just a sample to make sure you should at least work on this, but you obviously should test it on other things. Which, yes, you are, yeah.
No.
You can use whatever Java classes you want. Okay, don't go and download a class that says inverted index and use it. Okay, you are supposed to implement an inverted index, but to do that you can use, those are just suggestions. You are free to use other classes. Yes, question.
Just to clarify, we do need to use a binary search tree.
Yes.
And the due date at the top of the assignment, I think, is
March 3rd. No, wrong. February. 2 weeks from now, not a month and 2 weeks from now. I'll fix that.
So like, yeah. February.
2 weeks from yesterday. Yes, your question. Yeah. So it can't be March 3rd. That's a typo. Okay. So the other thing is you can do this in groups of two. Okay. So feel free to form your group, get a feel for how you are going to work with your lab partner. So when the first real assignment comes, you are all set to go. Okay. You are welcome to do this by yourself. This is not a very complicated assignment, but it is a good excuse for you to figure out who you are going to work with for the subsequent assignment and form the group. Once you form the group, you need to tell us who your group members are so we can keep track of that. Okay, in our records, yes.
So the syllabus says groups of two or three.
You could do, I would recommend groups of two, but if you really want a group of three, that's fine. I mean, forming a group of three doesn't mean you will do less work. You will actually end up doing more work because of coordination. But if you have a good set of two friends, feel free to do it, but do keep in mind that you will have to coordinate, you will have to document what each member did, and so on and so forth, to ensure that all the work is being fairly divided. Okay, so we will let you have that flexibility. Any other questions on this? Okay, so only the last point I wanted to sort of mention, which is you will actually turn in everything on Spark, okay, all homeworks, and so what you will do is you will make a zip file of all your code, just upload it into Spark. Okay, this avoids any hassle of putting it in the EdLab and whatnot. Okay, you can use the EdLab to write your code and test your code and do whatever you want, but at the end you will just upload it as a single zip file into Spark. Okay, I am going to set that up. It hasn't been done yet, but later today I am hoping that I will have access to the site and will set everything up. Okay, and at that point I'll post some instructions here. So someone, yes.
Since we're doing it as a group, does everyone in the group have to turn in?
No, if you're doing it as a group on Spark, you will only submit once, but that's the reason you have to tell us in advance who your group members are so we know who that assignment was turned in by. Okay, so make sure you tell us. You don't have to turn in multiple copies. It will only cause confusion. Okay, yes.
About the book, did you say that it was available online?
No, I didn't say the book was available online. I said you could go to any online site and buy the book if you want to. There is a Kindle version of the book, which is, yes, so one of the versions, if you actually go on Amazon, you will see that one of the versions is sold as a Kindle edition, and that price is substantially lower than the hard copy. So if you like to do Kindle, you don't need a Kindle to do that, you can get a Kindle reader, you can save some money. But it's not available as an online book. Just, I just said you can go online and just buy it, maybe cheaper than going to the store, that's what I meant. Yes. I didn't hear. Are you going to have assignments? No, you will have some homework questions for which you will need to refer to the book. But we will actually post the questions. You don't have. We will not say question 3 or anything. We'll put the text here, so you don't have to worry. Which is why I said you can pick whatever edition you want, the 7th or the 8th. There isn't that much different there. Okay. Yes, there are some more questions.
You said
is the book a required text? I will put it on reserve in the library, a slightly older version. So you can refer to that. It is the textbook for the course. Whether you buy it, whether you share it with someone, you use the reference copy in the library, that is really up to you. I'm sorry? Well, when you have to review material for the exam, it's better to have a copy handy. But if you feel that you can get by with a library copy, that's fine. I'm not going to force you to buy the book. Okay, but just assume that, I will assume that you will have access to the book to read it and do whatever you need to do with it. That's all. Anything else? You got some question? Okay, alright. Okay, so let's stop here for today.